It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Stan Lee, the legendary creator of comic book heroes like Spider-Man, Iron Man, and the X-Men, died this week at the age of 95. We're going to spend some time this morning looking back on his life, his legacy, and his contributions to American pop culture, from the earliest days of Marvel Comics to the latest big-budget superhero films. Were you a Stan Lee fan? If so, how did you react to the news of his passing this week? And when were you first introduced to his work? Was it through the comics or his big-budget superhero films? Which Lee creation is your favorite? Spider-Man, Iron Man, the Fantastic Four, or some other character? What do you think Lee will be best remembered for? And what will be his lasting impact on American culture? Give us a call. Join the conversation. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to ideas@WPR.org. Or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Chris Yogerst, Assistant Professor of Communication in the Department of Arts and Humanities at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, is with us this morning. Chris, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning, John. Thanks for having me.
First of all, what was your reaction when you heard the news that Stan Lee had passed away?
It was actually, I heard from a student. I'm actually, one of the classes that I teach with a philosophy colleague of mine is a class called Superheroes and Mythology, where we study how mythological stories get rebirthed through other genres. And the superhero is such a prominent genre right now, particularly with its A-list films. And actually, a student just came into my office and was like, "Oh my God, did you hear the news?" And I, you know, that's how I heard. And of course, then I had to go online and see what everyone else was saying. And I mean, the guy was 95. He was doing something right. He lived a very full life, a very respected guy. One of the things that I was thinking about when I got an email yesterday to come on your show is what might be a good context to put this in, because even though Stan Lee was this major figure for a lot of people who read comics or watch superhero movies, I was thinking maybe not everybody knows why this is such a big deal and why so many people are talking about him. So I started thinking about a context to put him in. And I came to comparing him with somebody like a Jim Henson or a Walt Disney, somebody who's created just a ton of characters, or co-created a ton of characters that have this, that are going to live long past the creator who created them.
I think that's a fair context, and it certainly does give us a frame for this conversation. A lot of people are familiar with Stan Lee's work, but less so with the man himself. Can you maybe fill in some background here, if you will? Who was Stan Lee?
Yeah, definitely. It's an interesting story. So he was born in 1922 in New York. He was one of our greatest generation. He was born Stanley Lieber. And he actually, the name Stan Lee was a pen name that he created once he started working in comics. He started working at age 17. He lived through the Depression, started working very early to help his family, got into the comics industry. And at this time, the comics industry was not glamorous at all. I mean, when you look at the documentaries and photos of the early years in comics, it was very much kind of like early Hollywood, in the sense that it was just real scrappy and overcrowded rooms of people working on things that, you know, they didn't really think they were making history. The funny thing about his pen name is that he created Stan Lee because he wanted to save his actual name, Stanley Martin Lieber, because he was going to become this great American writer and write this novel, and he wanted to save it for something good. But what ended up happening, of course, as history would have it, is he ended up becoming the face of this industry and this stuff. But his first project, he was an assistant to Joe Simon and Jack Kirby at Timely Comics, and this is an early version of Marvel. And his first story credit was Captain America number 3 in May of 1941. So this is Captain America, one of the most iconic characters. And this is a pre-Pearl Harbor issue, which I think is interesting. But a lot of his early stories were, he was influenced by 1930s action movies, the Tarzan movies, the swashbuckling stuff with Errol Flynn. But he only worked here for a little while before enlisting into the Army. And he enlisted on November 9th, 1942, and he got into the Signal Corps and ended up working on the training films division after that. And this is where Frank Capra was. This is where he made the Why We Fight series that's been talked about a lot but with historians. But he wrote training films. He wrote film scripts. He created posters, instructional materials, a lot of this stuff used by the Office of War Information. And during his time, he kept in contact with the comic industry. It was still growing. He returned, and then he returned to what was Timely Comics again, and then it turned into Atlas Comics. And the superhero genre was going away a little bit, and he helped revitalize that. And that was one of his big early contributions. But that's really where he came from.
Stan Lee didn't invent the comic book or the comic book superhero. How did he revolutionize them?
Right, and that's why I came to the comparison with Henson and Disney, because these guys, you know, Henson didn't create puppets and Disney didn't create animation, but they really helped solidify the medium. And where Lee comes in is that in the 1950s, he lived through this interesting era where comics almost died. So something happened to the comics industry that was very similar to what happened in the film industry in the 30s. And a psychologist named Frederick Wortham wrote a book called Seduction of the Innocent in 1954. And basically, he was a psychologist in New York who was fearing that popular culture was a major contributor to juvenile delinquency. There were public hearings on comics. People were trying to legislate comics. There were public burnings of comics. It was a mess. So what they ended up doing was adopting a production code, not unlike, they basically followed exactly what Hollywood did in the 30s. And this was a way to avoid government censorship. And like I said, it almost killed the industry. So what Lee did, by the early 1960s, he started putting together and co-creating characters that, and again, during the 50s, the superheroes were not as popular. I mean, you had Superman on TV, granted that was DC, but he created the Fantastic Four with Jack Kirby, and these characters revolutionized the industry because they weren't just these all-powerful characters. They had human elements, and they were relatable. They were flawed, and particularly by the time you get to Spider-Man, you have this kid essentially who has these superpowers. He's trying to deal with the loss of some family members, and he's also then trying to deal with these supervillains. So that's a character that Lee created with Steve Ditko, but where his biggest contribution during this period was how he ended up ending the censorship reign. So you had this code of ethics that said you know what you can and can't publish. So one of the things he wanted to do by the late 60s, early 70s, he wanted to do a Spider-Man issue that dealt with drugs. And there's a lot of conversations of drugs during this era, but the Comic Code Authority would not allow him to depict drugs. And his argument was, well, it's an anti-drug issue. It's an anti-drug series. They still wouldn't let him publish it. So what he decided to do is publish it without a seal of approval. Generally, you needed the seal of approval to get the issue released. He decided to publish it without the seal of approval. It became a huge seller, and that opened the floodgates for people to get a little more courageous and creative.
Chris, we need to get to a break here, but we'll continue that story in just a moment. Chris Yogerst is with us to talk about Stan Lee. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Stan Lee, the legendary creator of comic book heroes like Spider-Man, Iron Man, the X-Men, died this week at the age of 95, and we're taking a look back on his life and legacy. Were you a Stan Lee fan? Did you, as a child, did you get into all the DC Marvel rivalry stuff? I mean, I have to admit I did. I was growing up in the 60s, and that was kind of a thing then. When were you first introduced to his work? Was it through comics or through the films? And which Lee creation is your favorite? Share with us at 800-642-1234. Chris Yogerst is with us to talk about Stan Lee this morning. He's an assistant professor of communication in the Department of Arts and Humanities at UW-Milwaukee. Chris, when were you first introduced to Stan Lee's work, and what impact did it have on you?
Well, it's funny because I feel kind of blasphemous. I was a Batman guy growing up. So
hey, me too. A Batman, The Flash, yeah. I was a DC guy all the way.
For sure. So I've kind of worked backwards, where I got to know him much more recently and working backwards. Actually, the first time I was introduced to him was his cameo in Kevin Smith's movie Mallrats, which is absolutely hilarious. And I was like, I got to know more about this guy. But I think a lot of the newer stuff, the Iron Man films really got me jacked up about learning more about him. I knew more about him before I knew about his characters. So I think the newest movie trend has really caused me to start backtracking through all of his creations.
Well, Stan Lee was different than other comic book publishers because he was really out there. He was part of the work and was really up front, and you didn't see that in DC. It was more traditional, you know, granite-jawed superheroes who led lives of incredible purity and never had any moral ambivalence. And Stan Lee was creating characters that said, the heck with that, we're real human beings who just happen to have superpowers. And it was very controversial. There was a lot of rivalry when that came out. Is it fair to say that Marvel caused major changes in the DC universe as well? I mean, the characters we see now seem to be a lot different than the ones that I grew up with as a comic book reader.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's definitely a lot of talk about that. I mean, a lot of the DC characters are, that's what's interesting. There's a lot of criticism of the DC movies right now, and particularly when Batman versus Superman came out and people were complaining it was too dark, but the comics were pretty dark. And that's something that Marvel has been able to transition into film a lot more effectively with their franchises and make them accessible and make them funny. And I think that the popularity of those movies is definitely impacting DC, and they're trying to figure out how to make their movies work like the Marvel ones are. So I think that rivalry has transitioned into film now.
Well, how much involvement did Lee have with the films themselves? How much of the success of these films can we credit to Stan Lee?
Well, and that's a good question. I was trying to dive into that a little more last night because it's you know, when you look at all the new movies, he's always credited as an executive producer. So and that can mean a variation of things in Hollywood. But as active as he was, I'm guessing he was giving input on variations of levels on all of these projects. I mean, he was certainly making the cameos still, which I heard we still have two more to go. But he came to Hollywood in the 80s and with very minimal success was trying to get superhero movies onto screen. And this was the same decade that Michael Uslan was trying to sell Batman, and it took him 10 years before Warner Brothers would pick it up. All the studios declined at first. So Lee ran into similar issues, and I think his biggest contribution is just remaining the face of the genre, the face of the industry, and really becoming a superhero himself.
Let's take a call. Brian joins us from Superior. Brian, good morning.
Morning. I've been a big, big Marvel fan since the mid-60s when I was a little kid. But everyone who knows me knows I talk about comic books way too much, but especially Lee, Kirby, and Ditko. I just want to, I don't know if you've talked about the Marvel method of creating their comics back in the early 60s when Kirby and Lee would get together and hash things out. And they would just, when you don't necessarily write anything down, Kirby would go home and draw it, and it might not even relate to what they talked about. And then Stan would edit it, write it, maybe send it back. And the fact that Ditko So there was a story once that was Dr. Strange, and we had no idea that he was doing this. He had no involvement at all, and he has admitted that in the interview once. And it seems like Ditko and Kirby are kind of, they weren't aggrandizing, or they couldn't, they didn't have that public persona that Lee did.
Brian, thanks for your call. What about the Marvel method? What was different about that, the way they created stories, as Brian points out?
Yeah, I mean, this was there's a lot of comparisons between early comics and early Hollywood, where the writers were making lots of stories very quickly, very cheaply, and this is something that, I mean, the caller brought up a good point about the relationship between Joe Simon and Jack Kirby. I mean, they created some wonderful stuff. The relationship wasn't that great. And a lot of parts, I think a lot of the success of Stan Lee over the years is just being in the right place at the right time. And he was able to create these characters or co-create these characters, but more importantly, able to sell these characters to a mass audience in a way that nobody else could do it. And market them in a way no one else could do it, and help them be relatable to a way that no one else could do it.
And they were, you know, Lee seemed to be kind of a provocateur. I mean, he introduced the kinds of candidates that superheroes and characters that nobody else was doing at the time, and really pushed a lot of boundaries. That really worked for him, didn't it?
It did. It did. And that's why I wanted to bring up how he pushed the censors back with Spider-Man. And then during that same time, what he did is he had on one of the back pages or on the back of the issue, he had Stan's soapbox where he would give his personal opinions on things. And people have been posting their favorite ones on social media. And that's one of the things I'm working backwards on and reading some of the things that he was saying to readers at that time.
Comic books still alive and kicking, but with so many entertainment options out there now, sales of comics seem to be trending downward. With that in mind, is there room for another Stan Lee to come along and revolutionize the comic book industry once again, or is that impossible in this environment?
Oh, wow. That's a really good question. It's definitely more difficult because there are so many options and our attention is being pulled in so many directions. And going back to my original comparison of Henson and Disney, I mean, we've got so many of these characters now that are, they can live on their own. You know, we've got, you know, Netflix continually coming out with new Marvel shows. Season 3 of Daredevil just came out that I'm working through. And there's always room for revolution, though. There's always room for, there's always going to be somebody that comes along and changes the game. It's just a matter of time.
And many of us are too busy looking at cat memes on Facebook to read comic books anymore.
Right.
How do you, what lasting impact do you think Lee has left on American pop culture?
I really think, I mean, it's also a difficult question. I mean, the characters are so iconic, but I think that Lee's attitude and his just constant positivity and support of fans and connection with fans is something that will leave a lasting impact on anyone who's met him and those who haven't met him. And I really think it's just his personality and just the fact that he was just a really great guy in a really fun industry.
And whether we like them or not, superhero movies, big business, thanks to Lee and others, are they here to stay?
I think so. I think so. I think that, I mean, that's one of the things we talk about in our mythology class, these kinds of stories. They go up and down in popularity, but they never really go away. I think the superhero genre is a lot like the Western. It's going to have its day. It's going to become less popular, but it's always going to be there influencing.
Well, we've always liked a good myth. I mean, human beings love those kind of stories, and if you can tell them in an entertaining way, I think you'll always have an audience. How do you think Lee will be best remembered?
Oh, well, I mean, he's one of these people. One of the brilliant parts of his ability to brand was also his ability to brand himself. So he did, you know, some people might argue that he was kind of printing the legend and he was able to write his own story and all of that. But I think that, you know, the cameos in movies, I mean, you know, when you look at the new movies, every time he shows up for the split second he does, everybody cheers So I feel like he might even be remembered more than some of his characters, at least for the time being. As it goes, I think he's just going to be remembered as the face of the entire genre.
He certainly seemed to be a real branding expert at a time when people weren't even really talking about that term. So certainly he would be remembered for that. Chris Yogers, thank you so much for spending this time with us talking about Stan Lee. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Chris Yogers is an assistant professor of communication in the Department of Arts and Humanities at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Coming up, more reaction to the spate of dark store loophole referenda around Wisconsin last week. We'll get another viewpoint. You're listening to The Morning Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. 23 counties, cities, and villages around the state of Wisconsin had dark store loophole referendum questions on their local ballots. All of them were approved by large margins. So what's the dark store loophole? Well, when property in Wisconsin is assessed for tax purposes, the owner of the property can appeal the assessment. But what happens when businesses that appeal their property tax assessment seeking a lower amount are allowed to use empty stores or vacant land as evidence for their appeal? That's called the dark store loophole. Local municipalities say that when this happens, homeowners' property taxes go up, and they want the legislature to do something about it. Business groups have a different take, and that's what we're going to hear today. Was there a dark store referendum on your election ballot? What did the results look like in your community? How was it talked about before the vote, if at all? If you didn't get a chance to vote on a referendum question on dark stores, what do you want lawmakers to do? Or are you happy with things as they stand and don't want any changes? Let us know at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Corey Fish is the Director of Tax, Transportation, and Legal Affairs at Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. Corey, thank you for joining us this morning.
Good morning, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
Two bills that addressed the so-called dark store loophole failed earlier this year, and Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce did not support these bills. Why not?
We didn't support them because we think that they would unfairly increase taxes on the business community, as well as residential homeowners.
What would these measures have done if they had been approved?
Yeah. So, like you said, there's two bills. The first one would have simply created disparity between occupied properties and vacant properties, allowing tax assessors to assess property taxes on occupied properties more. The second bill would have allowed property tax assessors to value intangible assets tied to the property, such as mortgages and home equity loans, and claim that is property value, and therefore use the amortized value of an individual's mortgage to represent the value of their home.
Meanwhile, this idea of closing the so-called dark store loophole went before voters in the state in a number of local government areas. In the most recent election, the majority of voters who had one of these referenda on their ballot say they want lawmakers to close the loophole. What did you think about those results?
Yeah, I mean, I think, unfortunately, the only real indication that those results gave were that taxpayer-funded lobbyists are really good at writing biased and factually inaccurate referenda questions. I think it's really valuable when counties create advisory referenda in order to gauge voter opinion, but in order to accurately gauge voter opinion, a county should, or a municipal group should, write a question that is factually correct and non-biased. These questions weren't, I think it would be pretty hard for an individual who hadn't heard about the dark stores issue prior to going to vote by solely reading the question coming up with a reasoned conclusion.
And how much do property tax rates motivate businesses in terms of where they're located or do business?
They tend to be significant. So, and I think they can be more significant due to the fact that historically Wisconsin has had one of the highest property tax rates in the nation. I think the latest data was from 2017. We had the 14th highest burden in the nation. So they really do make a difference to property owners.
Are different rates a large expense or burden for business? Give us a sense of why they want to assess property value in the way that they do.
I think we need to make a clarification, because the issue with the dark stores loophole, or theory, as we would like to call it, is that property assessors for many years, not only in Wisconsin but nationally, have assessed property value based on the value of the property, the land, the improvements, the building, and the bundle of rights associated with the land.
Okay.
Now, assessors have suddenly decided that in the last few years that they want to add in the business value of the property on top of those things. So not only do they want to tax the actual physical property, they want to tax the commerce going on inside businesses, which can lead to drastic increases in property taxes for a business. And so that's what these businesses are really concerned about, the fact that they're being double taxed on their income. They already pay income taxes in Wisconsin, but now local property assessors would like to include business income in their evaluation for property.
But not everyone in the state agrees with that point of view. Some contend that this is part of a strategy by big box stores to avoid paying their fair share of taxes under current law. We had Jerry DeShane of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities on earlier this week, and that was certainly his view. A lot of this seems to get into the weeds of some tax policy. I don't know that everybody completely understands this. One of the arguments is that a vacant boarded up house isn't worth as much as one that's occupied and appears to be occupied, and that's part of the rationale here. What's your take on that?
Yeah, and so I'd say I completely agree with you. And I would be clear, WMC nor any of our allies in the business community are arguing that a vacant, dilapidated, boarded-up house or business should be used as a physically comparable property for a new business. What they want to use is two identical homes, one of which is vacant and one of which is occupied with a family. I don't think that if you were a buyer of a home and both those homes were for sale, that you would pay more money for the occupied property than the vacant one. And therefore, the occupied property shouldn't be taxed more than the vacant one, because what you're allowed to measure is fair market value. So if the fair market value of the two properties are the same, they should be taxed the same regardless of occupancy.
So this is an issue for you of tax fairness then. Others would say, well, listen, then the homeowners have to pay more. And really it comes down to, okay, so this person doesn't want to pay and this person doesn't want to pay. Somebody's got to pay. So where does the balance lie here would be one argument you could make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I completely understand. So I just want to say that I think there's been a myth perpetuated, or I don't think. I know there's been a myth perpetuated, and I think the Department of Revenue's data bears that out, that there's somehow been a shift in taxes to homeowners. That's simply incorrect. The Department of Revenue clearly shows that over the last 10 years and even going further back, there's been a steady shift in the property tax burden from homeowners to businesses in the state of Wisconsin. And because we have uniformity clause, generally what you should see when you're looking at the property tax burden allocated by businesses versus homeowners is how much business value, taxable property value do businesses own statewide? What is that percentage? That should be about the percentage of the tax burden they pay. And currently businesses are paying about 3% more of property taxes in the state than they own in property value.
If
they're paying more than their fair share.
Okay, if legislation such as was proposed in the last session, which didn't get to a vote, if legislation were to pass, closing this so-called dark store loophole, what would it mean for business in the state from your perspective? Can you put a number on it?
I can't put a number on it. I think you'll make it harder for businesses to expand, because it'll make it harder for them to seek out financing, because that's really what a major portion of one of these bills does, is it wants to tax financing agreements for businesses as real property. The concern with that is that obviously most businesses don't have enough capital sitting in their bank account to just inject into their business to create or expand it. So if you tax financing, it makes it less likely that businesses will choose to expand in Wisconsin or go to one of our neighbors that don't do this, because no other state in the nation does this.
We're talking with Corey Fish, the Director of Tax, Transportation, and Legal Affairs at Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, getting a different viewpoint on the dark store loophole story, which has been covered extensively here and elsewhere. A lot of newspaper articles with it, television news reports, and so forth. And so we're finding out more about this. Corey, do you expect that this issue is going to come up in the legislature again next year?
I do, yes.
There was a majority in favor of closing this dark store loophole in the Senate. Does that majority still exist?
That's a good question. So I don't think it's accurate to say there was ever a majority in favor. There were certainly a significant amount of legislators signed on to the legislation, but I'm not sure that who signs on to legislation is a good indication of how a vote will end up going in the legislature.
Do you have any sense of whether or not Governor-elect Tony Evers has taken a position on this, and could it be part of his proposed budget?
He has taken a position on both pieces of legislation. He's in favor of both of them, but I do not know if he'll put it in his budget.
Okay. What's your expectation here? If legislation does pass, do you think this is going to end up in court?
Yep. I actually think this will end up creating a lot more litigation, because we will become a national outlier in the way we assess property taxes, and that will mean that a lot of businesses will be, all businesses really, will be unfamiliar with quote-unquote new rules of the game. And so I think businesses, homeowners, municipalities will all find themselves in court in order to try to figure out how the new procedure works and what is the new definition of fair market value for taxes in the state.
I guess that message is one that may have been lost in the discussions of the referenda. What do you think you need to do to explain more to people what's going on here?
I think that people generally know two things. One is that there has not been statewide a shift in the tax burden to homeowners. And I think that, two, they need to understand that our state constitution doesn't allow for special rules on property taxation procedure to apply to certain types of property owners. You can't say businesses, you use this procedure, and residential homeowners, you use that procedure. So if a bill says that financing agreements for businesses have to be applied to their real property value, that means that those financing agreements for homes also have to be applied to real property value.
All right. Corey Fish, thank you so much for joining us this morning. I appreciate your time.
Yep. Have a great day. Thank you.
Corey Fish is the Director of Tax, Transportation, and Legal Affairs at Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. Coming up next, we'll be talking about awards for recycling and America Recycles Day. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson. Stay with us. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources awarded 10 programs, businesses, and organizations for their innovation and excellence in recycling. We'll learn more about the winners and what we can do to participate in America Recycles Day. Does your business or neighborhood take a unique approach to recycling? Tell us your story. What questions do you have about the recycling process? 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Three great ways to get in touch this morning. Jennifer Simrow is the Waste Reduction and Diversion Coordinator with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Jennifer, good morning. Welcome to The Morning Show.
Good morning, John. Thanks for having me, and happy America Recycles Day.
Well, and same to you. I expect that there's a greeting card for this, right, or not? Maybe not.
Maybe not. There could be. I think Hallmark has a lot of different cards, but no, it's just something that we celebrate in the recycling industry.
Well, I hope that if there is a card, that it's A, made of recycled materials, and B, can be recycled itself. Let's talk about the Wisconsin Recycling Excellence Award. What's the goal of this program?
Sure. Well, this program has been in existence since 2012 when the DNR wanted to recognize communities that were achieving outstanding efforts in their recycling program. So it was really based on data that was submitted to the department by communities on an annual basis. And we took a look at those who showed improvements and things of that nature. Since that time, we've expanded the program to allow communities to nominate themselves, other organizations and businesses to, again, recognize unique, innovative, and outstanding efforts in the recycling and waste diversion arena.
How did this get started?
So as I mentioned, we were trying to recognize programs that were going above and beyond and improving their recycling program. And so we wanted to create a recognition program that would allow us to not only recognize those communities, but when they were doing something innovative, share their stories so that others could learn from them.
Well, let's talk about some of the winners. There are four types of awards. One of the winners of the Projects and Initiatives Award was Milwaukee Zoological Gardens. What did they do that was innovative?
So as you would probably expect, a zoo produces a lot of waste, and a lot of that waste is animal manure. And so herbivores, when they produce manure, you are able to capture that material and, instead of sending it to the landfill, send it to a composting operation. And so that is what they investigated and did. They're working with Blue Ribbon Organics to divert that waste. The zoo has over 3,000 animals, and just one elephant alone produces hundreds of pounds of waste per day. So by diverting this material to a composting operation instead of the landfill, they are saving tons of waste each year.
Some of the awards went to organizations that found ways to recycle different types of waste. How did one of the winners find a sustainable way to recycle shingles, for example?
Yes, Badger Materials Recycling was the winner in that category, and they worked with partners Wolf, MCC, and Tri-County, and they've established a network, an infrastructure network across the state, primarily in the eastern and southern parts of Wisconsin, where they have four different locations where they collect shingles. They've also been very proactive in their educational outreach on that program because shingle recycling is unique. You need to do a bit more education and outreach to make sure that the materials that you're receiving are of sufficient quality. And so they really invested in that educational component of the program. So those were different areas that we wanted to recognize. The shingles that are collected are actually ground and used then in asphalt.
So we're talking with Jennifer Sumrow, the Waste Reduction and Diversion Coordinator with Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. It is America Recycles Day, and the DNR is handing out awards. Jennifer, educating the public, as you point out, is a large part of ensuring an effective recycling program. Tell us what the Helfenstein Group Council in, Helfenstein Soup Council in Green Bay did to win an innovation award.
Yes, they are a very unique organization, a nonprofit that is based in Green Bay, but they service many counties throughout Wisconsin. And they look at different materials, not as a waste, but as a resource. And so they conduct various workshops where they will teach their participants how to use scrap materials in innovative ways. So they've done things such as taking scrap wood and making it into birdhouses and signs. They create cat toys from burlap. They've made purses from blue jeans. We mentioned greeting cards with America Recycles Day. They do use reclaimed paper to make greeting cards. So doing some very unique things with materials that you wouldn't traditionally put in your recycling container but can be repurposed. And they hold workshops where they invite attendees in and spread this mantra of reduce, reuse, recycle. And their submittal indicated that attendees have gone away inspired to rethink about the waste they produce.
Let's take a call from William in Frederick. Frederick, my wife's hometown. William, go ahead.
Yes, good morning, John. A couple comments. I'm a volunteer up at the American Birkenbeiner Ski Race. And we had a meeting last night, and we were talking about they're looking down the future at doing more and more recycling every year. and they generate, just as an example, they generate about 98,000 paper cups for the Birkebeiner ski race. And so they're looking at ways of reducing that and getting into more recycling type of efforts for big events like that.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer, how is this an example of some of the innovative ideas you're seeing around Wisconsin, big events, thinking about, hey, what do we do with all these paper cups?
Yes, we did actually honor a program, Hilltopper Refuse and Disposal Services in La Crosse, the Onalaska area, for innovation in special events recycling. They've actually gone so far as to hire and bring on a designated staff person to look at event recycling and how they could improve that at events in the La Crosse area, because event recycling is especially challenging. You have people who may not be familiar with your local program because they've come in from out of town. The materials that are generated at an event are not always the same as what you would generate on a typical day. So they do have some challenges. Paper cups are, in truth, a challenging material. Oftentimes they have a layer of plastic, of a poly that helps, you know, the cup maintain its integrity. So there are limited markets for paper cup recycling. Some paper mills are able to take them, but not all. So if that is something that you'd like to look at in your local area, you should check with your recycling processing facility to see if they can take that material.
Schools are getting involved in this as well. Tell us about how Eagle River Elementary School revamped their school recycling program.
Thanks, yes. Eagle River Elementary School created a Earth Club where they're really getting their students involved in the recycling effort. There they actually have students that meet weekly and sort recyclables, so they really get an understanding of how to separate out different materials from one another, which is key when you are marketing those items. They've also done some innovative things with collecting non-traditional materials, so they have a program where you can recycle markers and crayons, for instance, or juice pouches, and they send those to a particular company that will repurpose those and recycle them. So they've been, again, really helping instill this in our youth, which we think is very important. It starts young, and if you can get children interested in recycling, that will continue through their life.
How can folks get involved in and participate in America Recycles Day?
Sure. There's a number of ways to do so. Areas of the state are holding events today, and you can learn more about local events by going to the National America Recycles Day website, which is easy to remember, americarecyclesday.org. Also, if you're just interested in seeing what's happening at the national level, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, is hosting an America Recycles Day Summit in Washington, D.C. This event will actually be live streamed on EPA's Facebook page, and their Facebook page is facebook.com/EPA. That event is this afternoon from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. Eastern time. Mm-hmm. And it's going to start with a press event, and then there will be a discussion on some of recycling's challenges and successes.
All right. Jennifer Simroe, Waste Reduction and Diversion Coordinator with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Jennifer, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much, John.
I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.